Welcome to the show, Conservation Connection. We do exactly what it sounds like. Every week, we introduce you to people working in the field of conservation. We're a husband and wife team. I'm Sarah Catherine.
I'm Chance.
And this is the show.
So bear with us because we're kind of figuring this new thing out. Like we told you at the end of the last season, we're going to start every show, the top of the show and the end of the show, with just kind of me and Sarah Catherine talking about what's coming up and what we just learned. So I hope you enjoy that because we are certainly enjoying figuring out this whole situation.
I can't stop laughing. Okay, so new season on coastal conservation. We have a 7-episode season coming at you, and this is the first week. So what's our show about this week, Chance?
This week, we're kicking off the season with an interview with a wildlife biologist for the Jekyll Island Authority, Joseph Colbert, who is studying primarily rattlesnakes, eastern diamondback rattlesnakes on Jekyll Island, but he's looking at them as a way to understand the health of the whole island. We call that an umbrella species. If you manage for an umbrella species, it kind of covers every other species in the ecosystem, and it manages for the health of the ecosystem as a whole, right? Because if the rattlesnakes are happy, that means that the rodents that they eat are happy, which means that the plants the rodents use for food and for cover are also happy, right? There's all of this cascading effects that happens if you're managing for that top level predator.
It's like the happy wife, happy life thing, right? It's like happy rattlesnakes, happy environment.
That's what you got out of that?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Well, so going into this episode, I knew like nothing basically about rattlesnakes. I mean, I don't know. I guess I knew that rattlesnakes were in lots of places, but like in my mind, there's lots of rattlesnakes in Texas. And yeah, that was pretty much all I knew is that people, I felt like, didn't like rattlesnakes.
Which is really funny because from my side of things, like my lab and my undergraduate degree, we had people that were out studying rattlesnakes on like the Outer Banks and other barrier islands. So this is actually an episode that I was really familiar with kind of the background of some of the studies and how you study this species. So I think that's kind of a cool dynamic that we see throughout this episode is my familiarity and your unfamiliarity with the subject matter.
Yeah, that's fair. Speaking of barrier islands, we do bring up kind of the first half or a little less than half of the episode is about barrier islands. So you'll hear some of that before we really do the deep dive into rattlesnakes and the research being done with them on Jekyll.
You're on an island, right? The rattlesnakes are not probably going off island to spread their genes. So there's kind of this really interesting little like microcosm of the environment that happens on an island, and we get to really dive deep into like, how do we study rattlesnakes on an island? Like, how do we know that we have found all of the rattlesnakes on the island? And spoiler alert, Jekyll Island has some really unique rattlesnakes because of how isolated they've been.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy to hear about. We actually got to go out with one of the biologists that works there and is studying there. You'll hear him mentioned in the episode as well. And radio track a rattlesnake, which was super cool. We'll be posting like some videos and pictures of that also.
Have you ever been around radio tracking in your life?
So I feel like we were somewhere where like we got to experience like how a radio tracker works or like saw it or something.
I think, but maybe, like, was it the game conference?
Oh yeah, it might have been
on Skidaway.
Yeah, so like in 2018, I think we went to a
Georgia Association of Marine Educators was the conference. Game.
Yes. We went to that conference and
it was about box turtles. They were showing us how they
was it box turtles or gopher tortoises.
I think it was box turtles because gopher tortoises burrow and box turtles are at the surface and you have to have line of sight for a radio transmitter to work. So
interesting.
So basically what it is you stick this transmitter onto and or into whatever it is you're studying and then you let them run out into the environment and then you can use this big antenna. It sends out this little bleep and your antenna picks that bleep up and it can tell you where that animal has moved to since you released it. Yeah. So we got to do that with a scientist on Jekyll Island. And what do we find?
Well, I have to say first, I have a lot more learning to do because when I think Michael was his name, was like radio tracking, for me, it was just like kind of like static. And I was like, okay, he's like somehow reading this. He was like, oh, no, it's back this way. And I was like, sure, Chance knew what we were doing. I was just kind of along for the ride.
For him, those little bleeps and bloops that his antenna was making was a song that he was using to find exactly where the snakes were. Mm-hmm. And like, literally, we're driving down the road and he's like, okay, it should be around here. We get out. He pulls out the antenna. And then maybe 10 minutes later, boom, there's a snake. Although there was a fun moment where he was like, okay, so usually once I'm at this level, that means the snake's within about 15 feet. Do you want to play find the snake?
And yeah, he was like, and he saw it right away.
Yeah. I mean, because he does this all week long, and I haven't radio tracked anything in a decade. So there was this fun moment where we're standing in the bush amongst the saw palms and ticks and bugs, which is a whole other story. And he's like, okay, so there's a diamondback rattlesnake. She's about 3.5 feet long, and she's within 15 feet of you. Can you see her? And it was super cool. I loved it. It was just a really neat experience.
It really was. And like, thinking back to it, I have lots to add to that story, especially about the ticks. But like, thinking back to it, I didn't have any fear. I don't remember feeling any fear of like, oh, we're looking for a snake. And like, he's like, oh, I see this snake. Can you see it? And I'm just like looking and I'm like, okay, I think maybe I see it. I'm not sure if I see it, but I'm going to say that I see it because I don't want this to be like it's taking me longer than a minute to see a snake that everyone else sees.
I completely agree with you that like it wasn't scary at all. And I've been waiting to tell the story since it happened. Yesterday, you asked me, as your husband, to cut your hair. And that was about 100 times more anxiety-inducing for me to cut your hair than it was to radio track a full-grown Eastern Diamondback rattlesnake.
It was just a very fun
experience.
Like, it looks okay. Honestly, we didn't do much. It doesn't look much different than it was. And my hair grows really fast, so.
I think you would look beautiful even if I shaved your head.
We'd maybe disagree on that. But anyway, he did a great job. We'll probably do it again. Saves money. Yay. Before we get to the interview, I do have to tell this story of just like being out on Jekyll and like looking for these snakes. We found the snake. It was super fun, super great. Michael recorded all of like the like plant life and everything around, what the temperature of the air was, what everything that a budding biologist has to do to make their recordings.
This man has a master's degree. He's going for his PhD in
exactly.
the fall.
Exactly. He's budding into a doctor. And we come out and we get in the car and we start driving and I see Chance just like picking things off of him and like throwing them out the window. And I see Michael doing the same. And he says, oh, I don't know if Joseph told y'all we have a really bad tick problem here because we have so many deer. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. Thing is, they're both just plucking ticks off left and right, throwing them out the windows.
Probably between us, we pulled 10 ticks off of just literally skittering across like a pant leg or like my arm.
You're probably uncomfortable thinking about it. I was uncomfortable being in the back of the car after this conversation and looking on myself and not seeing anything. And I was like, okay, they're picking lots of ticks off and I have no ticks on me.
So we promptly went to, very calmly and collected, went to the bathroom when we got back to their field office and went into the men's room and the ladies' room respectively and stripped butt naked and shook all of our clothes out because I was sure. I pulled 5 ticks off of my clothes, which means that there's about 1,000 inside of my clothes. Luckily for the both of us, we didn't find any ticks attached to our bodies.
I did. I ended up finding one scurrying across my leg, and then that was it.
But nobody bit us. So, no. So that was a good thing.
Yep.
Anyway, on that note, please enjoy this interview with Joseph. So right now we are sitting down with Joseph Colbert. He is a wildlife biologist here with the Jekyll Island Authority. And we're going to be talking a little bit about barrier islands as a whole, Jekyll Island specifically, and a really cool organism that he's using to kind of measure the health of this island as a whole. So Joseph, first off, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate y'all having me here. And, you know, I love talking about this kind of stuff. So thanks.
So can you tell me a little bit about certain, you know, what are barrier islands and what makes Jekyll Island so unique?
To start with, barrier islands are essentially islands that are pretty close to the coastline. Generally in Georgia, we've got a lot of marsh. Depending on what sources you cite, it could be 31% to 34% of the entire salt marsh within the East Coast. Wow. So our islands are going to be kind of connected to the mainland by marsh. We're still separated by this intercoastal waterway, but it's pretty much grassland, but also wetland at the same time. And that creates a distance between the mainland of about 7 to 9 miles, depending on where you are in Georgia. So when we think of barrier islands, you know, it could be a shorter distance if you're in, say, South Carolina, Florida, even North Carolina. Barrier islands offer a significant amount of protection from things like hurricanes, wind and wave action.
That's why we call them barrier islands, right? They're a barrier for all of these big energetic events coming in off of the ocean, and they help protect structures and, you know, even like erosion issues and stuff on the mainland.
That's right. And one of the unique things about Georgia, because we got so much marsh, it was really hard to do construction to build a roadway to barrier islands back in the day. You go to places like Florida, you go to places like South Carolina, you know, they got about a mile of marsh to get through. There's a lot more roads and a lot more development on barrier islands there. But Georgia, geographically, because of that challenge, has been protected from that kind of development. So we have what, you know, most of us would consider 14 barrier islands on the Georgia coast. And with that being said, only three of them have a causeway that connected to the mainland. Wow. So that's going to be Jekyll Island, of course, where we are. It's going to be St. Simons Island and Tybee Island. And then St. Simons is connected to Sea Island. So that's a fourth barrier island. And those are the barrier islands that we consider to have development on them. So what the other 10 barrier islands are doing is serving as a great reservoir for wildlife, a perfect barrier for things like wind, wave, and storm action. And they're kind of behaving more naturally. When humans move into the landscape, they definitely affect the way things, you know, occur.
Yeah.
Compared to the natural, you know, environment and all that stuff. So,
do you have any knowledge on like how our barrier islands formed? Because I know that like as ocean levels rise and change, you know, you get islands that occur wherever the coastline is. But do you know specifically like how our barrier islands came to be?
Some of that might be a better question for a geologist, but essentially I know that, you know, as glaciation takes place and glaciation recedes, we have like ice ages and we have these warm spells in which, you know, the barrier islands are kind of moved inland whenever there's an increase in sea level and there's this wind and wave action that kind of pushes sand and dirt and sediments up. A lot of these sediments are getting poured out in rivers and estuaries and stuff like that. And as they get poured out, that wind and wave action kind of pushes them into high ground. Maybe vegetation, like marsh vegetation, is established. And as wind and wave action kind of increases that sediment there, you start to see islands development and all that stuff. So there's more complexity than that, but that's kind of a very simplified way of, you know, summarizing it. But you can go inland and see about, you know, a 45-minute drive inland from where we are now and see where old barrier islands are. And that those are going to be sandhills is what they call them. And it's actually a really attractive place for mines. There are certain minerals, just like when you're doing like kind of gold panning and you move like this stuff around in the gold pan. You know, some things like gold will settle out because it's heavier and other things that are lighter will move away. That happens with wind and wave action where barrier islands are. And they mine for things like zirconium.
Yeah, and titanium dioxide.
Titanium, yeah, exactly.
I think it's just titanium oxide,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So, and they use things like that for kidney dialysis, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for making paint white. Titanium oxide is
sunscreen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of things that are white. So it's interesting because you're talking about it as like both this place where the ocean is kind of depositing sediment, but also rivers are depositing terrestrial sediment the same time. So you get this really interesting mix of, I mean, you think about how long the oceans stay in one place. You've got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years for stuff to deposit in an area. And this is kind of the ultimate repository of that stuff when the
that's right.
ocean is at a specific sea level. That's why you have them some inland, right? Up in like, was it Trail Ridge?
Trail Ridge, yeah.
Right, which is at the edge of the Okefenokee Swamp. That's an old barrier island from when the sea level was higher and the ocean came further inland.
That's right. And you know, you can see clearly that old Trail Ridge is kind of protecting that water in the Okefenokee Swamp from essentially draining out into the coastal plain. So, and we're kind of, you know, if we had increasing glaciation and sea level lowered, you know, we would be that next Trail Ridge and the next barrier islands would be further down, essentially.
Oh, that's a cool way to think about that. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah. And, you know, the other cool thing is that sedimentation, you know, these rivers flowing out, especially in Georgia, if you have a good free-flowing river that has no dams, no dredging, no impacts, you're going to get really healthy sand flow. These islands that are at the mouth of the Altamaha River nearby are doing a little bit better in that regard. Some of these islands that are closer to places like the Savannah River, where there's dams, dredges, and stuff like that going on, they're kind of experiencing a little more erosion than what's natural. So
you get a lot more like silt and like clay stuff in it as opposed to some of the heavier sediments?
You're getting a lack of sediments, essentially.
Oh, interesting.
And these islands, instead of being like kind of erosional, like Jekyll's erosional on the north end and accretional on the south end.
So it's like disappearing on the north end and being added to on the south end.
So when we think about an island like St. Catharines, a little bit north of us, where they're really close to the mouth of the Savannah River, all that dredging, damming, all that stuff that's interrupted the coastal sand tearing system is what we call it, has caused it to be more erosional.
Oh, interesting.
Then, you know, and so they're kind of eroding a little faster than they're growing, and it really affects things. Humans can affect even the island landscape unintentionally by doing things like building dams and dredges and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
A lot of that dredge material ends up getting taken offshore and dumped to a dumping ground. But there's a lot of experiments, and the Army Corps of Engineers and Georgia Department of Natural Resources have been working with us on a few things to try to figure out if we can use some of that material on the island in a beneficial way by kind of placing it carefully in the marsh. And seeing if we can kind of raise the elevation a little bit without changing the ecosystem. So there's some really cool things going on with that. We're trying to figure out better ways of managing the coastal sand sharing system where, you know, dredging is necessary because we got ports. Kings Bay, south of us, you know, there's a submarine base. There's no way they're not going to dredge that stuff.
Right.
And yeah.
Same with the Port of Savannah and all that. But
yeah, that makes sense.
At least we got the Altamaha River, you know, one of the four rivers that's not, you know, it's a good example of what things are in a more ideal circumstances.
Yeah, we lead a few like classroom programs and summer camps and stuff. And in that we have one activity that we lead with the students to show them like, okay, you all have homes on the river and you're going to build this big house. And then we line them all up and we're like, oh my gosh, you're all neighbors. How exciting. And like, okay, what kind of like pollutants like did your house cause like while it was being built or your property? Or like, oh, you have a farm. Okay. Like are you fertilizing? Like, and it all runs down to your neighbors at the end of the river. That impact.
That'd be a fun little twist on it to talk about, like, we've got a barrier island at the end. That's a Project Wet activity, by the way.
Yeah.
I've got a really cool kind of twist summarizing kind of what you're saying related to the barrier island. You know, if you go down to Florida and you're like on the edge of a river where manatees are, all that septic tank stuff is causing these plants to grow out there. And, you know, it's messing up the manatees. The plants that they normally eat are getting smothered by algae and stuff like that. So here it's a little different. So, you know, in the past, the Altamaha was flooded with sediments, and some of these islands grew way faster than the you know, normal speed of growth because farming practices that they just monocrop things like cotton. Cotton pretty much dies out for the winter, and rainstorms come and sediments
takes all that soil.
Pour out. There's no cover crop left behind, right? And that soil pours out, and it's caused some of the islands to grow. Well, in places where those islands have grown, we've seen a certain kind of habitat I like to refer to as maritime grasslands. Sometimes we call them muley meadows. They're just dominated by muley grass. Beautiful coastal habitat. It occurs in a very thin bandwidth of space. A lot of people are familiar with sea oats, kind of in those primary dunes. They love growing in the harshest environments right next to essentially the ocean dune interface. Mm-hmm. Right behind that is where you're going to see those muley meadows take root. And on islands that are growing like they should, we see those maritime grasslands dominated by muley grass like they should be. On islands where it's not growing as fast, we see that kind of like these shrub scrub habitats are catching up and getting really close to the sea oats essentially and kind of choking out that habitat.
Wow.
So we're seeing less and less maritime grasslands in some of these islands that are more erosional. And it's a habitat that I think about a lot because we're doing a lot of restoration with it on Jekyll Island. And
yeah.
We found out that we can actually burn the maritime grassland and keep some of the shrub scrub out. And, you know, it's still kind of a maritime grassland like it's supposed to be. So we're, you know, finding ways to manage some of these situations where human activities has caused a, you know, limited amount of this habitat to exist because of all these threats we're talking about. And, you know, we're trying to find ways to manage for them to keep them, you know, at least a reasonable amount of them. So,
yeah, absolutely. And we've talked a lot about like barrier islands as a whole now and like all these different ones, including Jekyll. And so now kind of coming back to your work and your position, what you do you work specifically on Jekyll or do you do any work on these other barrier islands or are you very like focused in on Jekyll?
Most of my work is on Jekyll, but I do partner with other folks in other islands for different reasons because I have to say this and I have to brag on the Georgia coast. I've been places where people are competitive. They kind of work in a silo. They're secretive. On the Georgia coast, we're extremely collaborative. We're really good about working with our counterparts. If somebody asks me a question about butterflies, I know the person who is in a community on Harris Neck who specializes in butterflies, and I can send somebody and put them in direct contact with them, and they can get them straightened out with the answers they're looking for. If somebody wants to know about rattlesnakes or something to do with snakes on a barrier island, normally they're going to get sent to me. And we, you know, when we start a project, if we want to do something maybe different outside of our comfort zone, I know the exact expert to go to around here. And when I tell you that we collaborate really well, we really do.
It's great. It's so valuable because science so greatly benefits from that sort of collaborative, like, I had this insight, but I don't know what to do with it. You know, can you put it in the context of your data set and see if that sparks anything? And there's this reciprocation.
That's right.
It matters. It really matters to know your neighbor scientists because everybody is a better scientist when they're having conversations with other perspectives.
There's only a handful of us that are full-time on Jekyll, but I've got so many folks that are partnered with us now doing so many things on Jekyll. It's amazing all the stuff we're learning. But yes, most of my work is here on Jekyll, and Jekyll is a unique place because unlike some of the other islands that are undeveloped, we have development. But also, the development we have is like limited to about one-third of the island. So in a way, we're a sustainably developed community. And one of the things that we, you know, pride ourselves on is kind of we still live in harmony with wildlife. We still have things like rattlesnakes that don't exist in islands, especially that have a lot of people. It's just, you know, one of the first things that disappears out of a landscape when people move into it are going to be predators because they have large ranges and a lot of like, you know, dietary needs that just get diminished when you reduce the habitat to essentially yards and houses.
And then you also have this human element of like anything that can cause me harm needs to go. What if my children sees one?
You know, there's that.
So it is a very common story across the world of when humans arrive, predators disappear.
Very much so. And when I first started working on Jekyll in 2011 in the lowest position possible, one of the first things we identified that we wanted to do research with, because at the time, you know, we're building a program, we're getting ready to start the conservation department and all that as we know it. We identified predators, plants, priority species, and problem species as kind of a major, like, you know, four groups of interest, call it the four P's. And I love talking to this about our staff, about this with our staff and our residents. But, you know, we think of like plant life, things that are limited and restricted, like sea oats to the dunes. They only exist in this narrow bandwidth of space we're extremely protective of. Spartina in the salt marsh. the maritime forest live oaks. Live oaks are amazing because just so many plant species grow on live oaks. Resurrection ferns, like three species of air plants, including Spanish moss, which everybody likes to see. And every time a raccoon climbs a live oak and poops in like a little hole that's got a little bit of composty stuff in it, something grows out of it, like a beauty berry. I've even seen prickly pears growing out of a live oak branch before.
Wow.
Yeah, and it, you know, I had to climb up there and try to figure out why. And, you know, it looks like a little compost, and there's a big pile of raccoon poop that's like ancient that dried up there. You can still see some seeds in it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, it's really cool. But you know, like these. The plants, so yeah, it's one of our peas, predators, and we identified alligators, bobcats, and eastern diamondback rattlesnakes as kind of our predator species. And predators are great because they're like an umbrella species. If you can manage for predators, you're managing for everything in the food chain below them. You're managing for, you know, the food that they eat. You're managing for the food they eat. You're managing for the insects that those things eat and the plants that those insects eat. So they're an umbrella species. And then we have priority species, which are, you know, things that are more limited. And that's going to be things like, of course, our sea turtles, which I know y'all have talked about. And I know a lot of folks think of like things like shorebirds and migratory species, pollinators, stuff like that. We've got, you know, lots of categories of priority species that we work with. And finally, problem species, because we do have development. We do have all these people. We have what we would consider problem species. And generally,
are the people the problem species?
You know, it's when people show up that the problems arise, right? Yeah. Like, you know, it's people's trash that these things are after. And also, it's
stuff
people
like rats
feeding
and cats
animals. Raccoons. Alligators, as soon as somebody throws food out to them, just like a dog at the dinner table, they learn to beg.
Yeah.
And now, you know, we're responsible for managing this situation. And we do, because raccoons vector diseases to people, rabies. They can vector them to your dog, parvo, distemper, stuff like that. You know, if your animals aren't vaccinated, they're at risk. So we have to be cautious about how close people are getting to these animals. And we have rangers that work with that. But we also are interested in doing research and seeing how these animals move around people. And we're actually getting ready to invest in some raccoon collars. We've done bobcat tracking. We've done GPS loggers on alligators. And we've done a lot of monitoring with pollinators and stuff like that. We radio track our eastern diamondbacks, which I'm definitely going to talk more about here in a little bit. But we've done a lot of things to kind of monitor these species in all these categories. One of the species that I absolutely love working with, it's like the flagship species of our program, is the eastern diamondback rattlesnake. We're talking about an animal that's a predator. So it's like that umbrella species. It's got a big home range. We're talking about an animal that if it's on a playground, and there's kids nearby, it's automatically considered a problem species. People are scared. They want to know more about them. They want to know that they're safe and all that kind of thing. So they are also a priority species. They were petitioned for federal listing in 2011 when we first started radio tracking them. And they're a state priority species. And there have definitely been kind of a free fall in population. There's been a big decline. And then finally, they're not a plant, but they're crazy about plants. They are a cover-dependent species. When we say cover, we're talking about, you know, plants that grow at the ground level. Plants that grow at the ground level support high densities of small mammals because they also need cover. If you drop a small mammal in a room in an open space, immediately they go run for cover. They go find a box. They go run against the wall if there's a fully open room.
Because they know that everything wants to eat them.
That's right.
They're the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches of nature, these small mammals. They
bobcats,
breed fast.
Predatory birds, even something just a little bit bigger than them, like a mink around here would eat a small mammal like that. So absolutely.
So they rely on these plant species, these cover plant species, to have the cover, which ironically brings in the predators, right?
Exactly.
It's where they're the densest.
That's right. As soon as you start having enough cover for those mammals to feel safe, they multiply, they boom out. And that's where the diamondbacks would like to be, somewhere where it's dense vegetation, where they can find the small mammals they like to eat. And the vegetation's dense enough that humans aren't going to walk and stumble on them and step on them. They don't like to be stepped on. That's why they have a rattle.
That's literally the whole point.
Exactly. You know, they don't want some big, large deer stepping on them. They're going to rattle and let them know. But generally, what we found since we've been doing research with them is that they are crazy about plants. They like to be in really dense, thick stuff. And they're really not coming out in places where people are. You start mowing a lawn, diamondbacks won't really meddle with it. And so again, they're not a plant, but they're kind of like, you know, almost in that category because they're just crazy about plants. So they're, again, the flagship species of the program because they really suit those four P's that we really like to
So with all that said,
work with.
You've kind of we're honing in on rattlesnakes as this sort of measure of the health of the island, or like how it responds to, you know, disturbances, hurricanes, environmental changes, development, stuff like that, right?
Yep. And, you know, we first, let's go back to the threats. We kind of hinted at a couple of them. So they're threatened by habitat loss. So a lot of the habitat that used to exist throughout the Southeast, where their range used to be from Louisiana to North Carolina. Now there's like a little small disjunct population in North Carolina. They've gone extirpated or locally extinct in Louisiana. They're very limited in Alabama and Mississippi. And essentially, Georgia and Florida are the strongholds. They're kind of in the some of the southern parts of South Carolina, but they're starting to become more disjunct there. And a lot of that has to do with, well, one, habitat destruction. A lot of the traditional longleaf pine savanna and grassland habitat, those unique ground cover dominant habitats, have disappeared. You know, we've taken things like fire out of the landscape. And what grows in after you take fire away? A bunch of hardwoods and pines. And then you see at the ground level, maybe a few shrubs, but it's not the kind of place small mammals would hang out in like they would back in the day, where every time lightning struck, it would burn this ground cover for miles and days and, you know, large swaths of land. So there's that part, fire suppression. There's agricultural, you know, dominance of those landscapes where, you know, it could be maybe monocropped or reduced down to a tree farm, which doesn't suit diamondback rattlesnakes anymore, right? And then, of course, development. You know, that summarizes threats that involve habitat destruction. And then, of course, you mentioned earlier the persecution of rattlesnakes. People have strong feelings about rattlesnakes because they feel like maybe they're doing a civic duty. They're out there, you know, killing a snake because it might strike their horse or their kid or something like that. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about it. You know, I know people do what they feel like is best for them. Generally, if you give them 30 foot in 30 minutes, they're going to move on, and really they don't mess with people. But, you know, one of the things we want to do is educate people and let them know that there's other options. But on Jekyll Island, we want to be that kind of reservoir where people can still see them in the wild, and they're not out here trying to kill them and stuff like that.
So, which brings up another really interesting role of barrier islands, is that they act sometimes as reservoirs of species.
That's right.
As places where species can, you know, adapt more strongly to the local environment and become at least somewhat differentiated from the mainland species. And if something happens on the mainland, they could potentially repopulate back out. You know, it's like a safety measure. If something happens here, we still have them there.
That's right. You know, now we're going to talk a little bit about island biogeography now that you bring that up, because, you know, the first question is are these islands connected to the mainland? And
can genes from the mainland get to this island and vice versa?
Exactly. And as island biogeography has it, you know, the further you are from mainland, the more likely that is not going to take place. And the further you are from other island blocks, the more likely that's not going to take place. So when we look at the Georgia coast and we see all these islands, like, for example, St. Simons just north of us is really close to the mouth of the Altamaha River. So we think that there's genetics flowing downstream to places like that. And it's right next to Little St. Simons, which has a really dense population where they have that maritime grassland I mentioned earlier, lots of it. That's right next to Sea Island, which is also right next to St. Simons Island. If you look at some of these other islands, they're real similar. Jekyll is this one tiny sliver of an island by itself, right at the mouth of an estuary with no river flowing to it. So all that's to say that we're really not experiencing migration from the mainland like some of these other islands. And what we see on Jekyll is that the diamondbacks here are genetically and phenomically distinct from all the other populations. There was a guy at Florida State, Mark Margis, who did some research with this. And he looked at diamondbacks all across that range, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina. And he's gotten samples from all those, venom and blood. And he found that there is like three distinct populations. Everything west of the Suwannee River identified as this kind of western population. This is in Florida, the Suwannee River in Florida. Everything east of the Suwannee River kind of identified as a distinct population. And Jekyll identified as this genetically distinct island population that's kind of on its own.
Wow. That's a really significant finding, because when we talk about the importance of this diversity, different genotypes, different strands of DNA, basically,
yep,
allow a population to respond differently to environmental challenges, you know? So I have not read these studies. I'm completely throwing this out there, but it's possible that, say, rattlesnakes on Jekyll have genetic basis for physical or behavioral traits that allow them to survive hurricanes better, you know, or that allow them to seek out cover or, you know, a specific type of food source that's only available on islands.
Yeah, that's how I like to think about things. And if you ask somebody, you know, that's like, well, why should I care? And a lot of times, you know, we might say even like there's like a medical application. Their venom's different here. So like, what if there's some kind of medical application to that venom that, you know, doesn't exist elsewhere? Now right. They're genetically isolated and it's a little different. So there have been research studies that found that eastern diamondback rattlesnake venom can be used in, and I'm not exactly sure how it's used in these medical applications, but they've used it to treat specific kinds of breast cancer. I know that even like copperhead venom has been used in scar tissue reduction. Other rattlesnake venom has been used in other kind of cancer treatments and stuff like that. So there's this utility, you know, there should be a concern about a population that's isolated by itself, just in case there's something like a reservoir of who knows what kind of application, but we would think that something's going on here. It's either drift because they're just getting a little different because they're not getting migration, or more likely because venom is highly positively adapted. And by that, I mean that it adapts in a way that is more suitable for the place they're at because there's this arms race. All prey that rattlesnakes feed on have some venom resistance. So the venom has to change to kind of, you know, be able to tackle that resistance that develops over time.
It's kind of this like common cold issue, right? Where or influenza, right? Mm-hmm. You get a flu shot every year because the flu changes every year because it's constantly trying to find its way. I mean, I'm anthropomorphizing here, but as it changes, it gets around our defenses. So we need new defenses. So
exactly.
As rattlesnake venom changes, so too does the venom resistance of the small mammals that they're eating. And so the venom has to change again. And then the small mammal resistance changes again. And it's just back and forth.
I think Chance and I have talked about this before, and maybe it was in Texas or somewhere. I feel like they were finding that rattlesnakes had stopped like shaking their rattle as like because they were getting killed instead of being like, oh, if I shake my rattle, it's like, hey, I'm here, and it scares whatever away. It's like, hey, I'm here. And someone's like, great, I'm going to kill this because I don't want it to bite me.
And now you're talking about essentially like people actually like finding like, you know, individuals with boldness traits and removing them from the population. So the ones that have more shyness traits are proliferating, and here they are.
So we're making rattlesnakes that are silent. More likely to be quiet when you step next to them, which is not what we want.
Not what we want, but I will say this, and not to scare anybody to death, but I've gone out in the field looking for rattlesnakes a lot of times because we do research with them. We radio track them. I have seen people step on rattlesnakes before, and they just sit there and they don't move, and they don't want anybody to know that they were there. They just hope they don't get stepped on again because they don't want to get their heads lobbed off, essentially.
Right.
I think it's probably to that point here, and it's probably more common on the East Coast. I mean, the more exposed a population is to people, the more likely this, what you described earlier, is going to be the case. And it certainly seems to be the case pretty much anywhere that I work around people, that rattlesnakes don't rattle when people are near them. They just sit there confidently and rely on their camouflage.
Interesting.
I would be really interested to see if they have a differential rattle response to a human versus another large animal like a deer that's less likely to cause mortality if they notice them. Like if that has worked its way into the population traits yet.
I wish I knew more about that. the only time I've ever seen a snake rattle, an eastern diamondback rattle at an animal in the wild was an armadillo. If you know anything about armadillos, they're about as blind as can be. They have a great sense of smell. But this armadillo was digging right next to this rattlesnake near a little hole it was hibernating in, and it kind of started rutting around like right in front of it. And the rattlesnake just rattled a couple of times, and the armadillo kind of looked real shocked for a moment. And then it scurried away about like 7 or 8 foot and went about its business.
It worked.
It didn't rattle at me when I was standing right next to it taking pictures and recording data, but it rattled at that armadillo when it approached it. So
interesting.
And I mean, you know, they get used to some of these snakes that we track get used to seeing us on a regular basis. And maybe there is an aspect of that, but I can tell you that the ones that we catch for the first time that have never seen us or been a part of our study, it's generally the same response. So I don't think it's us conditioning them that are doing research with them.
Right.
I think it's definitely, like you say, like I think the ones that are bold are They're not here anymore. Huh?
Yeah.
It's pretty much the ones that have more of those, like, you know, methodical, careful, shyness traits that are, I think, out there in the environment.
Surviving now. Better. Yep. Mm-hmm. So to dive a little deeper into specifically your work, like, what is the logistics of, quote, studying rattlesnakes? Does that, you know, we talked about radio tracking, collecting samples, and how do you use those logistics to get a better picture of the health of the island as a whole?
Good question. It's a pretty big undertaking. You know, we have staff that are dedicated to managing this project. Right now, this year, I have Michael Brennan working for me, and he's getting ready to move on to a PhD project at UGA to do more research with rattlesnakes here, which is wonderful. It kind of expands our capacity of what we can do. But what it really involves is, you know, we have to go out there and we have to find rattlesnakes. Then we have to bring them
in.
Which is hard.
They're so cryptic.
They are very cryptic. That's the word. They are stealth ninjas. They are camouflage as can be. And, you know, you think that bright yellow pattern that would stand out like night and day in the landscape, it doesn't. It looks like sun and shade mixed together underneath dense ground cover, like we called it earlier. And, you know, you go looking around in there and you can look right at them and not see them. We know this because we radio track them and we're like, we know it's right there.
Yeah, where is it? Sometimes, it's right here.
Yeah, right here. And then you finally get resolution on it and, you know, you can kind of see through some of the vegetation and you start to see it and then it stands out. But their camouflage is such that it's easy to overlook them in the field. So it takes a lot of effort to find them. When we find them, we bring them in. We have a partnership with the Georgia Sea Turtle Center. Our conservation department works with them really tightly. It's great having a veterinarian staff and an ecologist staff work together. It allows us to do so much more. But they do our transmitter surgeries for us, and then we get them back out in the field pretty quickly. And from there, it's a matter of going out with this radio tracking equipment. They've got this, you know, device inside their body. It's about the size of, let's say, a AA battery with an antenna on it, and it gets tucked inside their body. It has to go internal. You can't put a collar on a snake. You can't really glue anything on the outside of them either because it falls off pretty quick, we found.
Yeah.
So it's internal implant only. And then we're out there tracking them. You know, it used to be twice a week that we tracked them for many years, and we've met a lot of the objectives we needed doing that. So we track them once a week now. But we're trying to kind of increase our sample size. We know from some of our past projects where we went out to do essentially surveys for diamondbacks that there's about 60 individuals on the south end of the island, roughly. And we think based on that data, there's probably maybe like 30 on the northern end of the island. So that's 90 individuals on the entire island that, you know, this population relies on. And that's further complicated. And the reason I tell you this separately is that those two populations are separated.
Oh.
We have a lot of golf courses in the middle of the island. When I tell you that they don't like open spaces or mowed lawns, that's one of the smoking gun proofs I have that they don't like open space. They don't like, we've only had about 54 road crossing and 9,000 points we've collected on 54 individuals we've tracked. You would think it would be more in a place with roads like this. But it's not. And a lot of it has to do with that open space and that vulnerability they experience when they're in open spaces.
Yeah. So to clarify, out of the 9,000 plus times that you've gone out and found a rattlesnake, you've only found it on a different side of a road 54 times.
If my review of the data is correct, yes.
That is so basically what that says is that unless there is a very pressing need or, you know, some other extraneous circumstances, most of the time, I mean, what is that? I mean, as a percentage, that's like 0.3, 0.5%.
It's very rare. And a lot of times it's happening for males that are taking more risks during the breeding season, or it's close to winter hibernation and maybe they want to go to a denser habitat on the other side of the road. But it doesn't fare well for the rattlesnakes that cross roads a lot. The ones that cross roads a lot, we've had three get run over because they were pretty much in really fragmented habitat.
Mm. Which is another selection pressure of, you know, if we're talking about boldness traits being selected out, if you're a bold rattlesnake that crosses roads or rattles at people, you're more likely to die early. If you're not so bold, if you're shy, you're going to pass those shyness traits on to a greater percentage of the population.
That's right. You know, going back to what you mentioned earlier about finding rattlesnakes and them being very cryptic and, you know, us doing those surveys, we found out how hard it was to find rattlesnakes when we did these population surveys. You know, a lot of folks are like, how do you estimate populations for rattlesnakes? You know, if you want to go estimate populations for deer, you can ride around in a truck with a spotlight and you can count deer and you can relate that to the rest of the space that you didn't spotlight, right?
Right.
Rattlesnakes, it's a different story.
Well, especially with, I mean, herps or herpetologically, very often we do road surveys, right?
That's right.
Literally, you just drive down the road at sunset where the road is warm and a lot of animals that need to use that heat to warm up. That's when you find them.
That's right. And when people are like, can you go road cruising on Jekyll? I'm like, it's not going to be very fruitful. They just don't seem to cross very many roads around here. So,
wow. So that's a huge complicating factor in doing a successful population survey.
Here's how we deal with that complicating factor. Step one, how often do you actually find a snake when it's out there? What we had to do is we had three people and we gave each one of them four snakes to track. In this particular instance, I limited them to their four snakes and they couldn't talk about the snake's behavior or what kind of stuff they were doing. They had to keep it to themselves. And then they went out there and they set up this plot that was about 100 meters by 100 meters roughly. And then the other two people whose eyes are kind of tuned into them would go out and survey those areas. And we found out how often they would actually find a snake when it was in the plot versus how often they didn't. And what it came down to is season does make a difference. In the summertime, they're in such dense, thick stuff, and they're so well hidden that less than 10% of the time we could find a snake if it's in a plot.
Wow.
In the wintertime, we could find them more often, but only for a few hours at the end of the day. In the spring, turned out to be one of the best seasons to survey. We could find them about 50% of the time when they were in a plot, but that was pretty much, you know, starting, you know, in the morning and working throughout, you know, the duration of the day. And that's why it was a little more attractive than winter. A lot of times you're going to find the same individual that, like, various, you know, stump holes or you know, wherever they hibernate underground and stuff like that. So
that basically gives you a sense of when we are doing surveys and we're trying to find snakes and in, you know, novel habitats, we don't know for sure that it's a snake here. When you find a snake, if you have a 50% success rate of finding snakes when they're there,
yep,
that actually represents two snakes or half a snake?
Well, it represents the snake that you found and the snake that you missed.
Right. That's it right there.
That's right. And that's essentially what the math comes down to when we made the population.
So if you find one in summer, when it's that thick stuff, that represents the one snake that you found plus the nine snakes that you missed.
Yeah. But the effort to find that one snake, you have to cover a lot more ground.
Exactly.
Which is why we chose to do our population census broadcast through the island in the springtime. So what we ended up doing is we divided what we considered habitable rattlesnake habitat, which was about roughly, it was about 240 hectares, which this never happens in like science, but it was almost evenly divided between what we considered high marsh, dune and forest on the south end. So we had this like even, you know,
perfect
kind
split.
Of third. Habitat types. Normally it's like way more disproportionately one habitat versus another. But and we surveyed about 8 hectares per habitat, which is about 10% of the island's habitable rattlesnake habitat that we considered for this study. And we looked at this several different ways. The population essentially ranged between 59 and about 82, depending on how we looked at it. Pretty congruent, you know, not far off, pretty reasonable. But about 59 or 60 individuals on the south end sounds like a pretty reasonable amount. That's one rattlesnake per 4 hectares. It seems pretty darn reasonable based on what we actually see out there. And we find a lot of the same individuals over and over. And that's kind of where we're at. We're actually working on a publication for that, several of us that participated in that study. And hopefully that'll be out there by the end of the year. But that was important for us to do after finding out they are genetically unique and kind of constrained to the island.
Well, right. I mean, these are 90 individuals that represent a line that doesn't exist anywhere else.
You know, what we really did this for is, and it's not a study that we can do every single year, but down the road, we'll do it again and we'll see how those results compare. But they are, like we, you know, like to say, it's a barometer for what happens on this island. We can look at populations and see how they fluctuate in response to things like hurricanes, developmental pressures. Some of our land management, we hope, increases densities like prescribed fire. In the future, we're actually going to be building a wildlife corridor right down the middle of the island. And that, you know, we hope that this connects those two populations that are disjunct from each other. that's going to be part of this golf course renovation that we're doing. Mm-hmm. We're going to take 7 holes back from golf, because there's 3 18-hole golf courses and 1 9-hole. And we're going to retire at least 1 9-hole golf course. It's a lot. It's a lot in the middle of the island, yeah. You know, they're kind of bringing it into focus. They're going to do a little more habitat and out-of-play areas. It makes golf more, I guess, cost efficient for the folks that are managing. They don't have to cut as much grass that way. You know, they can use the same amount of staff to do what they were kind of shorthanded to do in the first place, and relieve some of this stuff back to us, which allows us to be able to put habitat right down the center of the island. Yeah. It's very nice that the habitat they're going to retire, it's one of the wettest areas. It's the golf course that they close the most. It's in the perfect place for a habitat corridor. So it will actually kind of finally unify that southern part with what we call, like, again, ground cover.
Yeah.
From north to south end of the island, and allow us to establish what we consider the same thing as ground cover, but early successional habitat, grassy stuff that needs a disturbance, either needs to be mowed or burned or something, like flooded, just to kind of keep it, you know, from being dominated by hardwoods.
Yeah.
And we're going to set it up so that we plant the species that we want there. And we're going to make sure they're all native species. We're going to eradicate the turf grass that's out there. And we're going to manage it with prescribed fire. And we've already done a little bit of prescribed fire management in some of the out of play areas, little island patches of vegetation on the golf course, which suits a lot of species. Birds can fly over these open areas. They don't mind it. There are small mammals out there, but we think that a lot of predators like bobcats, rattlesnakes, stuff like that will use this corridor to traverse the island. And we're excited to see what happens. And maybe down the road, we do this population study again and see what rattlesnakes look like after establishing a little more habitat, creating a little more connectivity and stuff like that.
Talk about a living laboratory, right?
Absolutely. You know, an island is a great laboratory. It's, you know, when people are like, you know, what's your field site? Like, how far can an animal go on or off your field site? I'm on an island. Like, they're pretty much constrained to the island. Like, I know this is my laboratory. I know what my boundaries are, and I know what these rattlesnakes' boundaries are and stuff like that. So it makes for a nice, nice laboratory. It's very controlled and all that.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's awesome. That was actually one of the questions I wanted to ask you as we're wrapping up here, was like, kind of for the Jekyll Island Authority, was the next 5 to 10 years look like, which I think you already kind of answered partially with the golf course kind of taking some of that back and building that into the wildlife corridor. The other question I have for you though is, have you ever been bitten by a rattlesnake?
I'll answer that question first. No. It happened back in the day with people, because they would handle them. They would, you know, pin them and they'd grab them. Now we use tools. People in our profession don't get bit anymore. And, you know, a lot of people that, like, you know, would whip out their camera and like, they're like, they're going to handle a rattlesnake. It's so anticlimactic, and they're so disappointed because you just use a hook or a pair of tongs and you pick them up and put them in a box, and they're like, oh, that's it.
Just zero risk.
You didn't just grab it?
I'm like, what? Y'all wanted to see me die here? Like, I've actually heard them go, oh, you know, like, I'm like,
well, like, who are you rooting for?
It's safe this way, you know? So, you know, we actually train our folks that work with rattlesnakes and teach them how to use tools and resist any urge to use their hand for anything. And that's worked out for pretty much every project I know of, where people use tools and do not use their hands.
Nice.
Our 5-year program, definitely the corridor is a huge part of it. That's going to be 34 acres of newly established grassland on old golf course areas that are retired. And it's going to be about 32 additional acres of forested habitat that we kind of underbrush and establish more ground cover in there. And there's wetlands inside of that area too. So it's going to be 114.5 acres when it's all said and done.
So it's really a relatively small percentage of the island that is going to be changed in the wildlife corridor that's being established. But it's going to make a huge impact on how the wildlife of this island can use the whole island. Because even if there's this great part in the north, if they're cut off by golf courses, there's no access to them or no transfer between the populations.
And again, we think of these rattlesnakes as an umbrella species. So if rattlesnakes can't move through an open area, there are other species that, because things are fragmented into small parcels, can't do it either. And by creating that corridor, you know, it's going to benefit them, we hope. We're not 100% sure. We're going to be recording data to find out. And that's what a lot of what Michael, I mentioned earlier, is going to be doing when he enters his program at UGA, is kind of monitoring these rattlesnakes through that corridor expansion and establishment. But
But that's what science is. You know, you're figuring things out, taking data and making your best guess based off of what you know and working forward from there.
That's right. You know, further along, as far as the next 5 years, we're going to be doing more prescribed fire on particularly the north end of the island. It's not just a wildlife management issue, but it's a safety issue. There's places that haven't been burned for as long as we know. We don't know when the last time, you know, lightning struck and burned, but we're in one of the, I want to say that I've read literature that suggests we're in the Southeast, we're in the third highest lightning strike frequency in the world.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty high regardless, but you know, there's high likelihood of lightning striking on an island and burning habitat. It happened north of us. St. Catharines burned extensively. Mm-hmm. Cumberland south of us has burned extensively. We were lucky several years back. I want to say it was 2017. We had a lightning strike right close to the entrance of the island in a very small fragment. And the Georgia State Patrol was actually out doing training with helicopters for wildfire wow. suppression. Oh, and they were able to bring in water really quickly, but that could have spread. Crazy. And we have development. We have tourism. Right. We have an economy that's built on like our ability to get people on and off the island. And that was right by our gate.
Right.
And it smoked for weeks because it was really droughty then. And yeah. that's kind of what happens. These lightning strikes don't always happen when it's raining.
Right. So you want to do a controlled burn before
we're going to start burning. We're going to start burning the north end of the island. And we know that should benefit based on all the data we've, you know, been able to read and understand about rattlesnakes and small mammals and other species on the island. It should increase densities of a lot of our wildlife species we care about.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for being on the show with us. This has been a super fun episode. I love talking about, snakes are just intrinsically fun for me, but talking about them in the context of this umbrella species that if you manage for snakes, you're really managing for the health of the island. So you got to know what's going on with them has been really fun. And I just wanted to give a thank you to you and a thank you to the Jekyll Island Authority for letting us come out here and hear some of these stories.
We're really grateful to share some of these stories with y'all and really appreciate y'all.
Wow. So I hope you were hoping to hear that much about barrier islands and rattlesnakes when you clicked on this episode.
It was definitely, I think this one was our longest episode
we've
done.
With the new intro and outro, it will definitely be the longest one we've ever posted.
Yes.
So what did we learn this week?
Tons about barrier islands. Like, I think one of my favorite things was learning about how, like you said, glaciation and stuff. And so we have these places inland in Georgia now that used to be barrier islands, like Trail Ridge by Okefenokee that you brought up. And now, I don't know, they're just like in the middle of Georgia. Like, who
right.
knew?
Right. As the sea level rises and falls, the barrier islands they're always on the coast. So as the coast changes, the location of the island also changes. So yeah, I thought that was, I think I knew that in the back of my mind, but I don't know that I've ever discussed that explicitly. And then I also feel like I got such a deeper knowledge this week on rattlesnakes. Some of their...
Well, that was the point.
Well, that's fair. Okay, I get that. But like, even as somebody who has been pretty involved in the world of herpetology, studying reptiles and amphibians and stuff in the Southeast, I had no idea that rattlesnakes did not cross roads. I mean, out of over 9,000 times of looking at a rattlesnake, or, you know, locating a rattlesnake, only 54 times did they find one on the other side of a road. That is 0.5% of the time did that rattlesnake move across a road, which is only 15 feet across, 20 feet across. For the rattlesnakes, it represents this almost insurmountable barrier unless they are under this, you know, big pressure of looking for new habitat or looking for a mate, you know?
But is that with all rattlesnakes or just the rattlesnakes we were talking about on Jekyll?
I have to imagine it would probably be true of most eastern diamondback rattlesnakes as a species, but I don't have the data to back that up, so I could be absolutely wrong about that.
Well, I was assuming it was specifically the ones on Jekyll, so that just brings a interesting thought up now. We'll have to look into that.
I know that rattlesnakes in general are considered a cryptic species. So cryptic being like hard to find is basically what that word means. So I know that they're considered a species that's really difficult to locate in the environment. Part of that is that they don't like to be out in the open. So I have to imagine across the whole species, they just don't really like to be on roads.
Okay. Well, thank goodness they're building their new wildlife corridor on Jekyll. I was super stoked to hear about that project and am really excited to see it eventually when it's done. Although I'm sure it's going to be a few years.
Yeah. And I really liked being on Jekyll Island and learning about how they're managing the island because it's what he said. They live in harmony with nature. And that's really cool. There's not a lot of like really well-developed areas that take that into account. So that's something I really liked about being on Jekyll Island. And then on top of that, we got to go physically see rattlesnakes, which was so freaking cool.
Yeah, that was really cool.
So what do we have coming up next week?
So next week, I'm super excited. We're going to be talking about a topic and an animal that for some reason I just love. I didn't know about them maybe like 5 years ago, and once I found out about them I was like, wow, I love these guys. We're going to be talking about gopher tortoise which is super exciting. They're super fun. They're just, I don't know what it is about them, I just they're cool little animals.
Yeah, they're really neat. So we have an interview with Dr. Barbara Blonder at Flagler College, who has studied gopher tortoises both in their upland longleaf pine ecosystem, but also coastal ecosystems. So you have this kind of like non-hurricane prone area ecosystem, and then you have this hurricane prone ecosystem, and looking at how gopher tortoises are responding to these massive ecological disturbances. It was such a cool episode.
Yeah, I think our listeners will really love that episode. It's just fascinating, and we cover a few different things, and not to spoil anything, but she also has another job that's really interesting that we kind of dive into the episode, so be sure to check in. I didn't spoil it. I had to try really hard not to.
You did a good job. No, thank it's super you. Cool. So yeah, check us out next Tuesday. We're dropping our next episode in this Atlantic coastal conservation season.
In the meantime, if you have a minute to spare, leave us a review on Apple or Spotify, wherever you listen. We would so appreciate it. We recently got a review last week or the week before from somebody whose username was...
It was either Louisa or Louis A. I'm not sure. I don't have enough context, but it was an amazing review, basically saying how much they liked the show and how it's inspiring them to get back into the field of conservation. And I gotta tell you, that made my whole week. I don't know about you, but I was like...
It made me want to cry.
Yeah.
Like, truly.
Sincerely. So we really appreciate it. Your feedback and your reviews really, really matter to us. So if you'd like to help other conservation-minded people find the show, leave us a review wherever you listen, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere. We would really love to hear from you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.
See you next week.